So the miracle had happened, hadn't it? Pharaoh, battered under those 10 fearful plagues, had at last been forced to yield. His army, in one last desperate attempt to prevent the Israelite escape, had been devastated in the waters of the Red Sea. And so now the Hebrews, against all the odds, have made it. They're on their way out of Egypt, out of slavery, to a new identity as an independent nation, and to a new land flowing with milk and honey. And there, I've no doubt, the story would have ended. At least it would have if it was being told by one of our new 20th century apologists for the politics of revolution. The events of Passover and the Red Sea, they make a fitting climax, don't they, to the tale of Israel's epic liberation struggle. Moses, the triumphant freedom fighter. Pharaoh, the humiliated imperialist. The downtrodden and exploited Israelites, now laden with plunder from their former masters, marching into the eastern sunrise with light of hope, new dignity kindled in their eyes. It would make a glorious and emotive final chapter to some left-wing novel, wouldn't it? And we would close the book with a satisfied glow in our hearts, dreaming happily of how, released from their dehumanizing bondage, these victorious peasants would dedicate themselves to the task of building a new society based on mutual cooperation and selfless endeavor. Well, fortunately for us, the story of Exodus isn't being recounted from the romantic perspective of that kind of Marxist ideology. It's being told instead with the blunt realism that characterizes all biblical history. The inspired narrator, therefore, will not allow us the luxury of dewy-eyed idealism about these emancipated Israelites. He refuses to close his story with the triumph of the Red Sea, though he could have done. But instead he goes on with scarcely a pause for breath into the sequel that followed. And in so doing, of course, he ruthlessly shatters whatever optimistic illusions we may have entertained about the way in which political or economic achievement can actually change people for the better. Within just a few days of their Red Sea victory, we find these Israelites wishing themselves to be slaves in Egypt once more. Can you imagine that? Our left-wing novelist would have a hard job incorporating that twist into his plot, wouldn't he? After all, the revolutionary masses are the heroes of his tale. It's monstrous that they should be guilty of such a mammoth defection from the predictions of Marxist theory. I guess he would have to attribute such a reversal to reactionary elements in their midst, or residual bourgeois attitudes from the social conditioning of their imperialist bondage. But the Bible suffers no embarrassment about telling us the truth of this. It recounts this sad evidence of Israel's recalcitrance simply for what it is, a fact of our human nature. Not once do we read of these liberated ex-slaves complaining about their lot, not twice, at least a dozen times. Again and again in the space of 40 years, they rebelled against Moses, even threatening to choose a leader to escort them back into Pharaoh's arms. So constant was this grumbling of theirs that the recital of it seems to acquire a stereotyped structure of its own in the narrative. The format is always identical. Some minor problem strikes the pilgrims. They moan about it. Moses prays, and then God steps in to solve the situation. Indeed, so repetitive is the pattern, on occasions it's difficult to be sure whether one's reading about two different incidents or a duplicate account of one single incident. Even the details, like place names, sometimes seem to get a little muddled in the account. But the mood of this wilderness period of Israelites' history couldn't be more transparent. The people grumbled. The people grumbled. The people grumbled. We hear it again and again and again. And the Bible, for all the tedium of such repetition, never tires of reiterating it. That's what's refreshing about the Bible, of course. It can tell us the truth about people. Like Oliver Cromwell, who asked his artist to paint the portrait of him, warts and all, you remember. So the Bible feels no need to glamorize these emancipated slaves, or to whitewash their failures, to practice cosmetic surgery on their history. It suffers no humanistic delusions about them, you see. The Bible knows that the mere removal of external chains from human beings does nothing to make them inwardly good. As Jesus said, it's the heart of man that evil comes from, and it is therefore the heart of man that must be changed. The politics of revolution may change history, but they don't change people. And that's why fundamentally they don't change the world. Now the Bible paints these Israelites for what they were. Awkward, churlish, ungrateful, self-centered, perverse, before the Red Sea. And awkward, churlish, ungrateful, self-centered and perverse after the Red Sea. These liberated masses are not the heroes of the Bible story. Neither is Moses their leader. Now, there's only one hero in the book of Exodus, and that's the Lord. God himself, the God who perseveres with these obstinate rebels, till in spite of themselves, he brings them to the land he promised he would. 40 years on from that first Passover night, Moses stood on the plain of Moab, we read, on the very brink of the land of milk and honey, and he told the Israelites the truth about themselves. Know therefore, he says, that Jehovah your God is not giving you this good land to possess because of your righteousness. For you are a stubborn people. Remember and don't forget how you provoked the Lord your God to wrath in the wilderness. For from the day you came out of Egypt until you came to this place, you have been rebellious against the Lord. That, I say, is biblical candor about us human beings. It won't romanticize about us. It exposes the sin that lies in all our hearts. Be we imperialist exploiters or emancipated slaves, be we pagan Egyptians or even the people of God. It won't romanticize about us. Well, this morning our task is to examine this rather unflattering period of Israel's history and see what we can learn from it. Our study passage, you'll see, contains three specific examples of this grumbling that we've been talking about. Grumble number one is recorded at the end of chapter 15. It's associated with the place Mara. Grumble number two is recorded throughout chapter 16 and is associated with the manna. And grumble number three is recorded at the beginning of chapter 17 and is associated with two ends, Massa and Meribah, if you look at the end of verse 7. But because the general pattern of these three grumbles is so similar, instead of studying them in sequence, I want us rather to focus our attention principally on the central incident, grumble number two, which the narrator expounds most fully, and just draw some occasional parallels with the circumstances of the other two, where these amplify or illuminate that text. So we're going to basically look at Exodus 16 this morning. And I want us to do so looking for the answer to three questions. First of all, why did God's people grumble? Secondly, why shouldn't God's people have grumbled? And thirdly, why was God so generous to a grumbling people? At the end of our study, maybe we'll be a little less idealistic about human beings and a little more confident about God. First of all, then, why did they grumble? What's the reason for it? And of course the answer to that is that they thought too much about Egypt, isn't it? Verses 2 and 3. In the desert the whole community grumbled against Moses and Aaron. If only we had died by the Lord's hand in Egypt, they said. There we sat around pots of meat and had all the food we wanted, but you've brought us out into this desert to starve this entire assembly to death. It was the Emperor Napoleon, I think, who first coined the phrase that an army marches on its stomach. And that was a truth that Moses quickly learned. If the highway to the promised land had been hedged about with fertility and abundance, then it would have been okay, wouldn't it? But it wasn't. We read in chapter 15, verse 22, Moses led Israel from the Red Sea, and they went into the desert. That's the primary reason for all this grumbling, the desert. Why couldn't God have provided a more hospitable path? The desert is a tough place to live, especially tough on one's stomach. And Israel's grumbles certainly reflected that. Grumble number one, you see, had been about the quality of the water. 15 verse 23. They came to Marah, but they couldn't drink its water because it was bitter. How much they'd look forward after 3 days of marching through that dusty scrubland to reaching the oasis, and when they got there, yuck. It was undrinkable, at least to Israelite palates, which had not yet hardened themselves to the rigors of a nomadic lifestyle. So what do? Verse 24, the people grumbled against Moses, saying, what are we to drink? Look on to grumble number three, and you'll see it wasn't the quality of the water there, but the quantity of it. They camped at Rephidim, and there was no water for the people to drink. So they quarrelled with Moses and said, give us water to drink. So you see, after a few weeks, even the unpalatable water of Marah would have been welcome as a relief to their parched lips, but not a drop was there to be found. So they quarrel again. But in our central archetypal grumble in chapter 16, it's not water but food that is Israel's complaint. If you'll pardon the pun, it's a beef about beef, or the lack of it. There we sat around pots of meat, and had all the food we wanted, but you brought us out into this desert to starve this entire assembly to death, they say. A gross exaggeration, almost certainly, because there's nothing in the text to suggest that the Israelites, only a month in the desert, were already short of provisions. It was the monotony of their diet, rather than the absolute lack of food, that was irritating them. And the reason it irritated them so much is because they chose to remember Egypt. If only we had died by the Lord's hand in Egypt. There we sat around pots of meat, they said. Someone has commented, it was one thing for Moses to get the Israelites out of Egypt, it was another thing for him to get Egypt out of the Israelites. Already time has blurred the harsh memory of the austerities of their slave existence. Already all they can remember is the stew that they used to enjoy there. They could have thought about the beatings, couldn't they? The racist exploitation, the genocidal edict against their children. They could have reflected on the plagues of judgment, the Passover, the spoiling of their oppressors. They could have remembered the Red Sea deliverance and that hymn they had been singing so lustily after it. Most of all, they could have fixed their minds on the milk and honey, which God himself had promised awaited them at the end of their journey. But no, they were in the desert, and empty stomachs had the effect of casting a rosy hue around their memories of Egypt. There we sat around pots of meat and had all the food we wanted, they said, no doubt salivating at the thought of it all. And that careless misuse of their memories was really what generated their grumble. And that's often the way with us too, of course. Perhaps we expected the Christian life to be easier than our old life. But scarcely have we embarked upon it than we find ourselves like the Israelites, up to our neck in sand. Instead of using our minds at that point to strengthen our spiritual resolve and so get through that desert experience, no, we use our minds only to recall all the advantages of our pre-Christian existence. I remember once being told about somebody who just led a young man to Christ and was giving him a lift through London, and en route they had to pass through the red light district of Soho, and they saw all the advertisements for the porno shows and the sex clubs and so on, and this new convert of his turned to him and said, "Cool, if only I'd come here before I became a Christian." Well, it's not exactly the reaction one hopes for in one's new convert. But don't we all behave that way sometimes, just a little bit? "Oh, if I hadn't grown up in a Christian family," says the teenager, "then I would have sown my wild oats like everybody else. Who wants to be a coy, chapel-going virgin in 1985? If I hadn't become a Christian, I'd have been married, I've married that good-looking millionaire by now," says the single girl. "Now look at me, 28 and on the shelf. No prospects. If I hadn't been a Christian," says the student, "I'd be having a whale of a time this week at the May balls, like all my old mates. What have I got instead? Grape juice and choruses at the CU end-of-term party." "Now, if I hadn't followed you, God, I'd be much happier. My experience would be much fuller in a thousand ways. Here I am, dissatisfied, bored, frustrated. You've brought me into a desert, Lord, not a land of milk and honey. I must have been a fool to let that evangelist talk me into it. The Lord will provide," he said, "but he hasn't provided enough." It's the same for all of us, isn't it? The austerities of the desert make us remember with affection the Egypt we left behind. We forget the ruin and the misery that sin brought us. Just remember the pleasures of a worldly lifestyle. We forget the mighty acts of God's deliverance in our lives and ponder rather all the sacrifices we have so begrudgingly had to make for his sake. We forget the joys of our heavenly inheritance that he's promised us. And instead we just become peevish and resentful about the adversities of our earthly pilgrimage. It's always the same. Jesus had to rebuke just this attitude in a Galilean crowd that followed him after the feeding of the 5,000. His mind was very much on this passage in Exodus at the time. Don't work for perishable food, but for food that endures to eternal life. But like Israel in the wilderness, all too often our minds are fixed on things below rather than things above, on our stomachs rather than our souls. And that's why the people of God grumble. But why shouldn't the people of God grumble? The reason for that is because it's sinful. Pure and simple. Look at verses 7 to 8. In the morning you will see the glory of the Lord, because he's heard your grumbling against him. Who are we that you should grumble against us, says Moses? You are not grumbling against us, but against the Lord. Because it's the mug who is in charge of the group, who always gets blamed whenever people have a collective complaint, isn't it? And so it was with Israel. 15 verse 24, the people grumbled against Moses. 16 verse 2, the whole community grumbled against Moses. 17 verse 2, they quarreled with Moses. Poor old Moses got it in the neck every time. All their discontent was funneled down on him. All their spleen was vented against him. By in chapter 17 verse 4, we even find him saying, they're almost ready to stone me for God. That's so typical of us human beings. In our disgruntlement, we're always looking for a scapegoat whom we can point to and say, there you are, it's all your fault. And 9 out of 10, it's our leaders whom we so victimize. The story I rather like about is a boy in the USA who wrote to Santa Claus one Christmas asking him for $10 to buy something he particularly wanted for Christmas. Well, he posted his request in the United States mail, and eventually the letter was placed by an amused clerk on the desk of the chief postmaster in Washington. Well, he was touched a little by the Christmas spirit. So the postmaster put a dollar in an envelope and sent it to the boy at his home address. A few days later, another letter arrived in the same juvenile handwriting on the postmaster's desk. It read, Dear Santa Claus, thank you for the money, but next time don't send it via Washington because they deduct 90%. That's very typical of us human beings. Our wants always exceed our needs, and we habitually blame the shortfall in our expectations on the government, don't we? It's all their fault. It's always their fault. And the same is true in the vast majority of our Christian grumbles. We've got a problem, what do? We blame the church. Oh yes, it's the church's fault. We blame our Christian friends. We blame the pastor. If only all they'd done a better job, we would be in a happier condition, we say. Well, I want you to notice that Moses doesn't let us get away with that. You are not grumbling against us, he says, but against the Lord. Your argument isn't with God's servants, it's with God himself, he says. If you're not happy with your situation right now, it's not the church's fault. It's not your Christian friend's fault. It's not the pastor's fault. If you insist on blaming somebody, it's God you must blame. Indeed, it's God in a very real sense you are blaming, simply by grumbling the way you are. And that is why grumbling is such a serious matter. You are not grumbling against us, he says, but against the Lord. Oh, I know grumbling is very commonplace in human society, isn't it? I know it's sunny now, but if it rains tomorrow, we shall grumble about it. The cost of living, who doesn't grumble about it? It's an everyday occurrence. Grumbling is so common in our human society, it seems to be a very minor matter. A peccadillo at the very most. And yet, you know, it isn't, really. It's but a short step from minor grumbles to accusing the Lord. Moses rebukes us all when he says here that when we moan against divine providence, it's a moan against God himself. It's something we need to think about. It's a denial of his sovereignty, you see. It's an impeachment of his goodness. Indeed, it goes further than that. For according to Moses in chapter 17, verse 2, when we grumble, we are implicitly putting the Lord to the test. Do you see that in 17:2? Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you put the Lord to the test? In other words, parading our troubles and whining about our hardships is a kind of way of demanding that God should prove himself by doing things at our behest rather than according to his own sovereign initiative. Like a child who sulks in order to wheedle gifts from its parents. So our moans amount to an attempt to manipulate God into a situation where he does our bidding, meets our demands. It's precisely that which Satan tempted Jesus to do when he was hungry during his 40 days in the wilderness. Cast yourself from the pinnacle of the temple, he said. You shall not put the Lord to the test, was Jesus' reply. God's providence is something we humbly trust him for. It's only the magician who wants to manipulate the supernatural. It's the mark of the believer that he is content simply to pray, your will be done. That isn't fatalistic resignation. That is trust in the goodness of God. Pray by all means. Prayer is an act of faith. That's what Moses does in the situation again and again. He cries to the Lord, but don't grumble. For grumbling is an act of rebellion, and we dare not minimize the sinfulness of it. But that brings us to our third question, doesn't it? Why, then, was God so generous to a grumbling people? Look at verse 11 again. I have heard the grumbling of the Israelites. Tell them at twilight you will eat meat, and in the morning you will be filled with bread. Then you will know that I am the Lord your God. So God did provide for his people in spite of their sinful moans. He answered their longing for better food. And a similar generosity of response is recorded in all three of our grumbles. At Marah, he shows Moses a piece of wood that has the power to counteract the bitterness of the water. And at Meribah, in chapter 17, he directs Moses to a spring in the mountainside, which can be opened just by a blow from his rod. And so too here, in chapter 16, he supplies them with the more varied diet for which they crave. Meat in the evening, he says, and bread in the morning. And not ordinary bread either, manna from heaven. Do you think it was rather irresponsible of God to reward the grumbling of the people in that extravagant way? Wouldn't it have had a more salutary effect on them, didn't you think, if he had rather rapped their knuckles in some way for all these complaints? Well, that may be so. On occasions, God did do just that, particularly later on in their wanderings. In Numbers 11, for instance, later on in their pilgrimage through the wilderness, we find he answers their grumbles with fire from heaven rather than bread, and sends plagues amongst them. Perhaps by that stage in their journey, he felt they should have known better than to grumble. But at this early point in their pilgrimage, God is comfortingly gracious to them, isn't he? And perhaps that ought to be an encouragement to any of us here who felt rebuked this morning about our complaining attitudes. Some fathers might react spitefully to the sulkiness of their children. But our Heavenly Father is not of that stamp. He constantly blesses us far beyond our deserts and beyond even our expectations, and he does so despite our grumbles. And if we ask, well, why is he so generous? It's important to note that he doesn't do so because he is weakly indulgent and can't resist our demands. No. He has reasons. Two reasons, in fact, I think you'll find in this passage as a whole. The first reason he has for being so generous to a grumbling people is that he has things he wants them to learn through the experience of his generosity. Look back at verse 4. I will rain down bread from heaven for you. The people are to go out each day and gather enough for that day. In this way, I will test them to see whether they will follow my instructions. So God's provision for his people then was in the nature of a test. A test of obedience, first of all. They had only to collect the manna according to his commandment. Yet in their attitude to collecting that daily manna, God says he would read an indication of a much deeper kind, whether they will walk in my commandments or not. Several things, it seems, mean quite a lot to God. Perhaps that daily routine of manna collection seemed a trivial and even eventually a monotonous task as it went on month after month, year after year. But there's a discipline in the trivial, isn't it, that we can't afford to neglect. And the spirituality of our characters is as much revealed in such little things as it is in big. Often the little things are a better index of our soul's condition than the big things. For in big things we can make a special effort, can't we? We can put on a grand show. But the insignificant routine of life brings out of us those attitudes and values which demonstrate whether we really possess a genuine habit of obedience or not. Just like the best test of eyesight is the small print in the newspaper, or the best test of cleanliness is the unseen corners of the home. So maybe the best test of obedience consists in little things, little acts of honesty, small habits of prayer, diligence in the common things of life, things which maybe men hardly notice. God ties some of his blessings to such minor obediences to test us. Like Jesus says, he who is faithful in very little will be trusted to be also faithful in much. But it wasn't just a test of obedience, was it? There was a very definite test of faith, too, involved in this manna collection. Look on to the passage we didn't read from verse 16 onwards. This is what the Lord has commanded. Each one is to gather as much as he needs. Take an omer for each person you have in your tent. The Israelites did as they were told. Some gathered much, some little. And when they measured it by the omer, he who gathered much did not have too much, and he who gathered little did not have too little. Each one gathered as much as he needed. Then Moses said to them, no one is to keep any of it until morning. However, some of them paid no attention to Moses. They kept part of it until morning, but it was full of maggots and began to smell. So Moses was angry with them. Each morning everyone gathered as much as he needed, and when the sun grew hot, it melted away. You see, the delicacy with which God arranges this special provision for their needs so that there's only ever enough for their immediate requirements. If they took too much, it didn't avail. If they took too little, they weren't short. And if they tried to save it overnight, it went bad. This then was a daily provision, wasn't it, this manna? They would learn through it to trust God daily. Moses in the book of Deuteronomy puts it like this. God humbled you, he says, and let you hunger and fed you with manna, that he might make you know that man does not live by bread alone, but by everything that proceeds out of the mouth of God. We may do our best to provide our material security. We can take out our insurance policies and put our savings in the bank. There's nothing necessarily wrong in that sort of thing, is there? So long as we realize how very precarious such so-called security is. Because the safest worldly investments can miscarry. And we mustn't complain if they do. If our manna carefully stored perishes overnight. But God's word has always warned us that worldly investments are no substitute for daily trust in God's provision for our needs. Give us this day our daily bread, he taught us to pray. Not, dear Lord, guard my pension fund. Now, by all means, we must make provision for our families and for our futures, but beware lest the world's miserly preoccupation with that kind of thing erodes the practice of a daily dependence on God's provision. Don't grumble or complain that we don't seem to accumulate in the same way that some men do. For if the Lord smites our manna and makes it rot, it is so that we may learn to trust him. It is a test of obedience, a test of faith. But two, there was a test of priorities, wasn't there? And that's the last part of the provision that is talked about in chapter 16, from verse 22 onwards. On the sixth day, they gathered twice as much, two omers for each person. And the leaders of the community came and reported this to Moses. He said, this is what the Lord commanded. Tomorrow is to be a day of rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. So bake what you want to bake, and boil what you want to boil, and save whatever is left, and keep it till morning. So they saved it until morning, as Moses commanded, and it did not stink or get maggots in it. That really is most interesting, isn't it? Only one day were the people allowed to gather enough for an extra day, and that was the sixth day. And God provided the extra then that they needed for the day of rest that God had ordered them to keep. There's an important lesson in that too, isn't there? But of course, if the devil can't persuade us to put our trust in our bank balance, in our pension funds and so on, then he will try the opposite track. He'll try to persuade us that our material situation is so very insecure that we can't possibly afford time for any physical rest or recreation. Oh, I must take this work home. It's got to be finished tonight. The Bible study? Oh, well, we'll have to give it a miss this week. Oh, I can't afford to close my shop on Sunday. We've got a lot of trade then, and my competitors are open. Oh, no, I can't take a holiday this year. Much too much to do in the house. So it goes on.
We let the nerve-wracking, maddening rush rob us utterly of our Sabbaths, the rest upon which so much of the quality of our lives depends. So we're robbed of our depth. We become spiritually emaciated, like spiritual anorexics. We live dissipated lives, squandering our energies in a multitude of things and becoming so exhausted. We have no time for prayer, no time to read, no time for the family, no time for church, no time for God. We never put any spiritual weight on. I sometimes think the most diabolical device modern science has ever invented was the wristwatch, you know. So precise now, it buzzes at us with digital precision to make us keep our appointments and to apportion off our time for us. It's a symbol, surely, of this restless activism that robs so many modern men and women of their tranquility, that makes urgent things drive out important things. Now, the Sabbath was the sign in Israel's weekly schedule that she had the right priorities. It was a test. A test of obedience, a test of faith, a test of what really came first in her lifestyle. God's gift of manna then may have been generous in view of the people's grumbling, but it wasn't indulgent. No, their grumbles revealed rebelliousness. They revealed mistrust. They revealed worldliness. And so God's provision was so designed as to test, and in the very process of testing these areas, to instruct them in them. And I'm sure the same will be true for us. If God is good to us, it is not as a sop to silence our moans. Don't think that. It's much more likely to bring with it a curriculum to assess our obedience, to assess our faith, to assess our priorities. God is generous to his grumbling people, first of all, because he has a lesson for them to learn. Look around for the lesson, then, if God is being generous to you. But I said there were two reasons for this unexpected generosity, didn't I? Yes, there's a second. And that you find at the very end of chapter 16. It's this. God intends to get his people to the promised land, grumbles or not. Look at verse 33. Take a jar, Moses says to Aaron, and put an omer of manna in it. Then place it before the Lord, to be kept for the generations to come. As the Lord commanded Moses, Aaron put the manna in front of the testimony, that it might be kept. The Israelites ate manna 40 years, until they came to a land that was settled. They ate manna until they reached the border of Canaan. So there was one day's supply of manna that God allowed to last not just an extra day, but indefinitely. And why? Well, because it was a memorial to his faithful provision to his people throughout those long years of desert wandering. If that generation chose to remember the flesh pots of Egypt, God would make sure that generations to come remembered rather the manna of Jehovah. God does not let his people starve in the wilderness, you see. He not only saved them, he sustained them by a daily supply of his goodness. He gave them it little and often, so that they might learn to obey his law, so they might learn dependence on his providence, so they might learn to abandon their greediness and keep his Sabbath. But with all these lessons, he intended they should learn one thing more, that grumbling makes no difference to him, because his persevering love for them was unchangeable. He will get us to the promised land, even if he sometimes has to drag us there kicking and struggling. That's, you see, where the Bible's view of things is so contrary to our contemporary world. The reason the world today is lapsing into pessimism is because the world expects far too much from human beings. You see it in politics, the graveyard of so many utopian dreams of a better society. That football debacle in Brussels this week. Everyone was saying afterwards, how could they do it? They did it because they are people. Sinful, corrupt, and at times brutish. That's what people are. Didn't you know that? Only humanism would have us believe that people are getting any better, any different. They're not. Put your trust in people, and pessimism is the only end. Now, we mustn't expect too much from people. Come to that, we mustn't expect too much from the church. See, sometimes people bring this idealistic and unrealistic optimism about the perfectibility of human society into Christian things. They expect the Church of Jesus to be a community of unparalleled harmony and goodwill. And when they find someone in the church is being malicious or unkind about them, or when they hear complaints against the leadership in the church, or when they see division among the church members, they become disillusioned and unhappy and they leave the church and they go to find a better one. Only to find eventually that the same unpleasant things are going on there, and so they try again and again, till finally, in hopeless frustration, they pronounce all churches to be full of hypocrites and abandon Christianity altogether. Well, we need to learn the lesson of Israel in the wilderness. We must not expect too much of people. It's no part of Christianity to expect too much of people. Even the congregation of God's chosen people en route to the promised land aren't immune from the dissensions and the grumblings that are the consequence of our sinful human nature. The church is a pilgrim people. It isn't perfect. Never will be in this world. By schism rent asunder, by heresies distressed, that's what the Church of Jesus is and always will be, till he comes to reclothe her. We must never then get depressed because people don't come up to the high standards we would like to entertain for. It's only the Marxist novelist who must believe in the perfectibility of human society. Now, we have a better hope. Not a humanistic hope focused on optimism about people, a Christian hope focused on optimism about God. The Israelites ate manna 40 years. Till they came to a land that was settled. They ate manna till they reached the border of Canaan. That's the ultimate reason God is so generous to this grumbling people. Not because he entertained any utopian illusions about them. He knew precisely how rebellious they were and would continue to be throughout those 40 years. But he was determined to get them to Canaan. He'd gone on oath to that effect. And the manna that sustained them day by day during that long and often unpopular journey was the token of his divine commitment to them. You will know, he says, that I am the Lord your God when you are filled with bread. You and I this morning have an even better token of God's unshakable plan of salvation for us, you know. Jesus said, your forefathers ate manna in the wilderness. They died. Here is bread that came down from heaven that a man may eat and not die. I am the bread of life, he said. Of course there will be hardships on the Christian way. The desert is a tough place to travel, and this world is a spiritual desert. But God has provided us with heavenly bread far superior to anything the children of Israel ever ate. He has given us Christ, the bread of life. Why did they grumble? They grumbled because they thought too much about Egypt. We would grumble less if we did the opposite. Why shouldn't they have grumbled? Because they were impugning the goodness of God, challenging him to do their bidding instead of begging him to meet their needs. We would grumble less if we realized how sinful it was. Yet he is generous to grumblers. He's generous to us. Because just like the Israelites, he's determined to get us through to the promised land. Learn the futility of grumbling this morning. Be grateful for daily bread. Be still more grateful for the bread of life. Be grateful that you're making progress through the wilderness. Be grateful for that better world. Because I assure you of one thing. The one thing nobody ever does in heaven is grumble. Let's pray together.